netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today we're going to talk about the new Pirates movie, and I'm joined by Mike Seymour.
Hey, Jeff.
How are you?
Good.
So you've seen the film?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you've also recently been to ILM, and this is we're talking today with Ben Snow, who you've talked to previously and had a great podcast with, so I'm anxious to hear this one.
Yeah, no, we went up to ILM. Actually, this is my last trip to ILM. I'm back here in America now, but when I was here a little while ago, we went up to ILM and we spoke to Ben about the mermaid sequence primarily, because that's what they worked on. And, well, you know, on FX Guide, what we like to do is rather than cover absolutely everything, we try and pick on something and go in more detail. And I thought the mermaids were really interesting in this. Interesting problem, of course, integrating between a live-action actress and tales and stuff. And also, you know, getting the mix right between freaky horror and fun and sexy and, you know, it's at night, it's water, it's it's good.
So Pirates was also shot stereo with the Red, right? One of the first big films shot that way?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, if you trace the path, the Red 1 was used, of course, on Social Network. The Red 1 with the MX chip was what was used as the primary camera on Pirates, as you say, in stereo. And what's really interesting about that is both of that is the original Red 1, not the Epic. Now, the Epic is being also used, as you know, in Spider-Man 4 in stereo. And actually, there's one more stage after that that we can sort of talk about, which is that the next thing, like The Hobbit, is going to be shot on the Epics in stereo at higher frame rates, like 48 frames a second. But yes, now this is a absolutely gorgeous-looking piece of footage from a technical point of view, and it was just shot on the original Red ones with the MX chips.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but great comments about the quality of the pictures.
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, the film starts in England, which is unusual for a pirate film. But, you know, it's funny. I think it's really phenomenally interesting that you could take the bigger rigs, because obviously having Red ones, that's like a bigger rig in a stereo thing, out on the water and do all the kind of stuff that you have to do for a pirate movie. So it's great. And I've got to tell you, of the four pirate movies, just before we get to the visual effects, I think the third one kind of lost me. It was like, what the... But this one's back to being a ye old, funny, good pirate movie, and Johnny Depp's, it's just a good, you know, summer kind of blockbuster film.
Interesting. One of the Red One, though, was there any issues that you heard about with, like, rolling shutter problems with stereo or anything like that? Because that's always been one of the concerns with digital acquisition with stereo with certain cameras, and I know the Red One, the Epic's better than that.
Yeah, no, it's
in that regard.
The MX chips were better than the original M chips, but also the top camera is flipped upside down, and the reason for that is because of the mirrors. That means that both rolling shutters will roll the same way, if that makes sense.
Oh, okay.
So you don't have one rolling shutter going left, one rolling shutter going right.
Yeah, so it's solvable then.
Yeah, and also the other thing is, you know, ILM treated all of the footage when it came in and got it all stuff sorted out. And as you know, those guys are pretty clever up there.
Yes. All right, well, why don't we jump into the interview with Ben Snow at ILM?
So we're really keen to talk to you about Pirates. It seems like a really exciting franchise. And the first time that you've been the VFX soup in the hot seat, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I haven't really worked on the Pirates films, except I actually guest TD'd a couple of shots on Pirates too. But, yeah, it's actually pretty exciting. It's a different director, of course, and it's a slightly different style. It's not quite as giant, I guess, in some ways, but it's well, certainly our part of it. ILM's not doing quite as many shots.
Because there are quite a few fluid sims in the earlier ones that really pushed the boundaries of maths, because those fluid sims were going not only in the X and Y plane, but also in the Z, or which way you orientate your axes. And it felt like, at the time, that was pushing the boundaries of your water sims. But this film, what, are you back inside a kind of a sort of a better safety zone, or is it?
Well, it's a smaller zone, but actually the water challenges have been pretty amazing on the show, because a lot of our work takes place in a sequence where the pirates attack a bunch of mermaids. Or, sorry, the mermaids attack a bunch of pirates, and the pirates are trying to capture a mermaid. So there's a lot of fluid stuff. So the way we approached it was that we had a set that we built down at Universal Studios in the Falls Lake tank there. And it sort of recreates a set that they originally made in an actual location in Hawaii. And they were going to actually do location shooting there until someone on the crew pointed out that there'd be 6-foot swell at that time of year, and shooting at night with a bunch of stunt people and pirates in the water may not be the best thing. So they shot a couple of establishing shots on location and then recreated this cove at Falls Lake at Universal. So we had wave generators and that sort of thing. We had stunt people in the water and pirates in the water. Our hope was to use a lot of the splashes that we got from the real performers. And we actually were able to do that, but we ended up really creating a whole bunch of little plugins and tools to add splashes dynamically. As we had the mermaids swimming, the splashes would be auto-generated. And then we also did nuke plugins to take filmed splashes or shot splashes and put them in automatically on cards and that sort of thing. So we used every trick.
Which is sort of sounds simpler than it is, because if you shoot a splash as a lock-off, well, obviously you've got a locked-off camera, but yeah, the shots you're going into are often moving, mm-hmm, and you can't really track on water, and even something floating on the water isn't going to be stable.
So it's a tremendous challenge. Merely, you know, like, we had a wave generator that sort of would wash back and forth and create waves in the tank. And yeah, as soon as you start tracking, let's say you've got a mermaid sort of swimming backwards or doing something across the surface, then her trail will go with her, but you want a nice foamy trail left behind. As soon as that starts happening, then the waves come into play. So what we're doing is that sometimes having to recreate the water surface. Right. And so we use our deep water tools, some of the same sort of tools we used on the previous Pirates films, to do that. And then add a lot of new sort of foamy splashes that we kind of are creating in a couple of ways. We're using our proprietary water tools, ILM water tools.
So is that pass with the foam created by the same sim that's doing the water, or you're running like additional sims for splashes?
Additional sims at a finer resolution. So the sort of cage or the mesh that you use, the volume that you use is more high res. And then what we do is usually take a sort of particle-y type sim and then use a mesher to sort of make a surface out of that.
So the actual mermaids themselves, how are you approaching that? Because obviously it's a bit hard to cast for a regular mermaid.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. It's actually been a big creative challenge on the film. Originally, and some other places had taken cracks at the mermaid designs, and Rob Marshall, the director, just really wasn't very happy. And so they asked ILM to take a look at it. So I was finishing up on Iron Man 2 at the time. John Knoll was involved. And so he went down for an early meeting. We did a round of art, took it down. Rob sort of liked some things, but didn't like other things. And then sort of sat down with myself and Aaron McBride was the art director on the mermaid stuff initially. And, you know, basically showed us some, God, there were even like, you know, pin-up photos and this sort of thing, of things that he liked. And so based on that, we came back and went and said, you know what, he really wants them to be a little bit more human at the top, but then they sort of have to change and become creature-y. So this is kind of cool. I mean, mermaids are an interesting creature, and I've always, like, you know, I've probably always been a little bit disappointed with how they've been portrayed in movies. I mean, they've been good. Some, like, Splash was pretty cool, I guess, yeah, and some others. But
it's a transition, isn't it? Because if you've got, well, take Iron Man,
yeah,
a suit. If you had a partial suit, there are probably some rigid lines we can use to define sort of real suit, practical effects to visual. But in mermaids, there's such a blending between the upper torso and the lower torso that there's kind of nowhere to hide.
It's really interesting. So really, you end up having to make a digital double if you're going to have the half and half. Now, what we'd originally conceived the approach would be is that they become really much more creature-y. So when they go into full attack mode, they are really savage animals and this sort of thing. And there were warning signs early on about this, but really when... it's an interesting production because we hadn't had a lot of contact directly with Rob until, you know, God, really quite late in the production. And he was, I think, the original mermaid that he liked was very human, and then we'd sort of proposed a slightly more creature variant for the non, you know, the more attack drone type,
less
soldier mermaid.
More, yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah. So Sirena, which is the main mermaid that you see in the trailer, is more human. And that there'd be this transition when they go underwater, actually. Or it's tied to the water. If they're wet, they can stay mermaid. And I actually came up with this whole bogus mermaid physiology about why they transform and when. But as Rob finalised his director's cut and became more heavily involved in the visual effects side, it really became clear that he wanted them to be beautiful women. So we got in the situation where we had real creatures, but we really needed to be doing sort of digital doubles at a certain point with the extensions. So that's actually been a huge challenge for us to catch up, play catch up with that a little bit. And in fact, we went back and shot some real mermaids, or real performers for some of the shots.
Well, one of the things about the earlier Pirates, which was really a landmark, was how unintrusive ILM's position was because of the idea of doing the capture from the primary camera.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because Rob isn't really known as an effects director. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love his films, but let's face it, they're not really of a typical ILM genre.
Right.
Were you conscious of producing an environment where those visual effects, once again, really didn't get in the way of what is, after all, quite a heavy effects film?
We did, and we were conscious of that, but he was also pretty good about playing, you know, along with what we really, really needed, as long as we could make the case for that. For example, for some of the transformations, and this again was, at the time, the plan was to make them much more dramatic transformations where they, you know, their faces would change and their hair would change and everything would change. So to accommodate that, we actually really did some work on our facial capture tools. And so what we'd have to do is go in and put dots on the faces of his leading lady mermaids. And, yeah, I mean, he was initially a little resistant to that idea, but, you know, we really impressed upon him that to get the track and be able to sort of execute these shots, we'd need that, and that it wouldn't be a problem to paint this out. And, of course, at the time, you're taking a little bit of a leap of faith because we're working in stereo. In some cases, you know, that some of the shots of Sirena, she's actually in a coffin, in water in a coffin. So you're going through all sorts of refraction in stereo. But the roto crew did a great job, and we also actually were able to amp up our roto tools to accommodate the stereo.
So you had a bunch of technical issues there because you were actually shooting in stereo, but also on the red ones. Mm-hmm. And some people will say it's easier to do effects at night because you can hide stuff, but you needed to see stuff to be able to work out what the tracking and the blending was. How did that work out?
It was pretty good. One interesting thing was that we settled on the reds because the DP actually did a sort of evaluation of different digital capture formats and compared them to film. And he really liked the look of the red. And his style is to really shoot very dark. You know, he really was raiding the camera. Like, basically, it was almost like an ongoing battle where we're like, okay, you really need to give us more exposure. But the camera could pick up this. You know, he could shoot by candlelight. Like, that would be his dream, just to shoot by candlelight. So, as a result, a lot of the footage was pretty, pretty dark. And, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, the studio ultimately is going to want to crank it up a little bit. So, and then we want to crank it up so that we see more detail. But, you know, he really was trying to, you know, basically use all of the abilities of the camera to capture really low exposures and not sort of give us, you know, what on film would be a thicker negative to play with.
I guess on the digital negative of an MX, you're going to get a lot of detail in the blacks, but normally you're worried about the clip and the white.
Yeah.
This was the red one, not the Epic.
Right.
But, of course, there is always the noise floor. Do you know what you were kind of rating the camera at?
Quote, it was like he was never supposed to go above 1,000 ASA. Okay. But, no, I mean, in the end, we had to make that 800. Okay. And then I think he had like an ND filter on it or something like that. But it was a fight to get him to really get enough light on there that we could say, yeah, that really is. It's not an underexposed 800 sort of thing. So, yeah, we did run into a little bit of noise problems. But one interesting thing about this was that we'd sort of formed a pretty interesting, good relationship with Red early on, with Dean and one of the guys there. And when we started looking at the colour science of it, they shipped up a camera to us and sent someone up, and we shot some interesting colour charts and actually had a look at some of the EXR conversion, because we like to work with EXR. Red line can convert to EXR, but the way it was converting to EXR wasn't the way we wanted it to convert to EXR. So we actually did some work with them to recalibrate that a little bit, and even actually discovered some stuff about the DPX conversions that One of our, Jerome Schulte, one of our software guys here, sort of did some interesting work with them. So we actually felt like at the end of it that we got a pretty nice dynamic range out of it that was appropriately adjusted for ILM's use, where we want 18% to fall in the right place, and then it can go over one, you know, it's not normalized. The old red conversion would normalize EXR to 0 to 1.
Right.
But we really just want the 18% in the right place, and then it can go over.
And of course, another advantage is, assuming you're shooting at sort of 24 frames, you'd be having 4K plates, which I guess would help as well.
Well, it's very interesting because this film was shot in stereo, as we discussed, but we wanted to shoot as close to parallel as we could.
Oh, really?
Now, with live-action films up till this point, they've generally used the sort of pace-based convergent thing, but... You know, what we were seeing in animated films and just talking about it, we felt like there'd be advantage to us on the effects side if we went parallel. And the stereographer, Rob Engel, made a case for going parallel. The studio talked to us and said, you know, what do you guys think? And we said, absolutely, we can't see any downside for this. It may actually give us an advantage, although we weren't really quantifying that it would. And I would say, having gone through it now, that... It definitely, compared to other stereo projects that we've done at ILM, it actually was less problematic using the parallel approach. So the way we accommodated that was tweaking the aspect ratio of the red so that we got a 4480 wide image. And then we would basically resize that down to 2K, so we got a 2.2 whatever. And then we'd basically take a 2K crop out of that. So we have 100 pixels of slop either side,
yeah, say, because
a little bit north and south.
A lot of the digital cameras are 1920 by 1080 because they're just an HD.
Yeah.
So having the red one would give you that reframe.
It gave us that extra ability, which is great because that means Rob, as he's doing the convergence, which is now built into the DI process, can tweak and change convergence, which makes editorially things a lot smoother. But it also, from a layout and from a roto standpoint, didn't necessarily give us huge speed increases, but it did actually mean that we ran into less problems than I think other shows have encountered.
Were you still running it through a pipe where you would run it, say, through Ocular? You mentioned Nuke.
We do, yeah. Yeah, we still do a prep plate process. So basically, we get the footage, we do a prep plate thing where we make sure everything lines up and is legit, because there are errors. You've still got a mirror, you've still got polarizing things.
Yeah, stuff around,
yeah. And the camera crew did a great job with the cameras, and they always, you know, had a spare rig ready and all this sort of thing. But, you know, boy, even the mirrors just get trashed. We were shooting by the sea. We really wanted the silver sort of backed mirrors to get really good, you know, quality. And they would just, you know, start decaying after a few days with all the salt water. So we sort of went through every mirror that was out there. So you get those errors. So we have a prep phase where you get the material, you process it and get it all lined up and legit so it looks comfortable to look at.
And does that involve a colour match at that stage as well?
So we do it initially as more of a layout phase, so it's done by a layout team and gets all those things. Then it goes and we do a colour match to compensate for the polarizer. Yeah. Yeah, so we do that as well. But it's sort of like two stages, because we also then combine that with a general colour correction.
Because I was wondering how much polarising was going on, because obviously water with a mirror, prime candidate for polarising.
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah, there's quite a lot. But what was interesting was when we started trying to eliminate that, the water felt a bit less wet.
Ah.
So you actually start saying, oh, we need to leave a little bit back in there.
Yeah, it's funny, because I've actually heard DOPs and directors of photography say that, like, a variable ND will take some of the sheen off a woman's skin, and some of that luster, and that can actually deaden a shot. It's that subtle.
Yeah.
And so you'd have found that presumably with the mermaids as well, the live-action actresses.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The You know, I think they, you know, Derek's just such a master with this stuff, and they really did look beautiful. I mean, I can sort of actually see why Rob Marshall wants, I want to keep the humans more. But
And the other thing I was going to ask you is, we talked before in the earlier pirate films, this magnificent thing of doing 3D object tracking and stuff with a single camera.
Yeah.
But you of course have, with a stereo setup, dual inputs for your solution for camera.
Yes.
So while it's crap in terms of water, it's actually a heck of a lot better in terms of actually having an offset presumably for the 3D.
It is. Now we took a little bit of a different approach to tracking on this film though, because we're going from the skin to skin. On the Pirates films and even on Iron Man to an extent, although it was a little trickier on Iron Man, they were doing full replaces. So as long as they wanted the joint positions, they wanted to capture the intent of the performance, but it didn't have to be super accurate. As accurate. On Iron Man, it had to be super accurate because you're tracking armor into Robert Downey Jr. But on this film, we needed the skin to be accurate. So it wasn't an eye mocap type problem anymore. It was a mesh. Can you derive a mesh from her skin? And so we sort of designed these psychedelic, like bicycle pants around where the transition zone would be. As I mentioned, we added dots to their faces. We also made these little henna tattoos, like our tracking bands. So, it wasn't quite as automated as the iMocap process is at its best, and we had to write some new software to actually derive the meshes.
But you would have two...
But we have a stereo pair. Yeah. And then often, on top of that, we would have a witness camera that we synced to the RED.
Okay.
So the beauty, you know, we had it was like a prosumer level camera, but we could get its time code in sync. And then often, you know, they would have, you know, more than one rig rolling. So we did get pretty good... Good results for that. And you know, it's still very hard though, like the big transformations where Sirena transforms into more human, it really is painstaking and you still have to go in, and even with the automated, we got pretty good automated head tracking and facial, but you know, getting the arms to perfectly match and the body, you know, we couldn't cover her completely with dots.
Or yeah, maybe it'd be wrong to think of it as an automated process, because at the end it's going to be down to the artist to sell that shot.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, it was good, though. But the stereo, actually, we thought would give us some advantages there, and that was one of the reasons that we kind of supported the studio's and the director's interest in going stereo.
Did you have to dimensionalise any shots?
Yes. Interestingly, underwater shots, they shot with the particular water housing that the underwater photographer liked wouldn't fit the two cameras.
So. Yeah. Plus, so, they normally have a dome on the front of an underwater housing, and you can't do that with two lenses.
It's harder, yeah. So we dimensionalised some of those shots. We actually had a very high success rate with the stereo, though. I mean, there was only one or two shots where, you know, it was where we recreated the other eye. Compared to Avatar, it was quite a low rate. Like, the stereographer on set said to me, you know, I won't accept any, because we were like, we budgeted for this amount of... you know, blown stereo, and they're like, I'm not going to accept, you know, 0% is what I want.
Zero tolerance.
Zero tolerance for it. And I have to say, they pretty much kept to it. It was pretty good. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a little pipeline on set where we would be just using the cards in the RED, just little, and so you actually only had 11 minutes of...
On the CF cards.
And the director was like, I thought the whole point of going digital was I didn't have to stop and reload every... But the beauty of that was that to the film crew, it was really like changing a mag, even though the cards, you know, you drop them in the water if you're not careful. So they would go back, and then we had those pairs, and they just backed them onto a drive, and it just all, and then we were able to take the data from the pace rigs as well. And so all of that data could go through the system. And, yeah, it's been, I have to say, that part of it wasn't nearly the headache I thought it would be.
Well, congratulations on the film, and
thanks
for talking to us. Really
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Well, that was great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I've just been back. I don't normally go to ILM quite this often. I've just been back, and we've been up there for 3 days filming more interviews, and I got up to go to Skywalker Ranch. I had not been to Skywalker Ranch before, and it's gorgeous up there overlooking Ewok Lake. And I've got to say, I just want to thank Stephen and Greg and all the guys up at ILM are just the nicest guys and incredibly helpful, and we really appreciate it.
We'll be seeing some of that soon?
Yeah, we've shot up there. We're also shooting down here in LA right now, so it's getting a lot of stuff done. But I think my record, I think we did 6 interviews in one day, and it's a bit exhausting, but it's great stuff, and we had tremendous access. We've also been down here in LA shooting at facilities. We've got more today, so that's great. It's all fitting in, of course, to FX Guide and to FX PhD.
Excellent. We'll look forward to people seeing that. Well, from John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser and...
Mike Seymour. Thanks, Jeff.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.